Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We the People, it famously begins, in order to create a more perfect union, and 8,000 words later, you will have read the American Constitution. In Washington today, opening statements by U.S. senators on the nomination of Judge Sam Alito to the Supreme Court. But the document behind the hearings has a lot more history than Alito. FDR called the Constitution the most marvelously elastic compilation of rules of government ever written. LBJ said it provides ample room for the fertility of American political invention. Humorist Will Rogers quipped it protects aliens, drunks, and U.S. senators. Yale Law School professor Akhil Amar has written its life story. Up next, On Point as Alito Sits Down, a biography of the American Constitution. Joining me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is celebrated constitutional interpreter and historian Akhil Reed Amar, law professor at Yale University. His new book is America's Constitution, a Biography. Akhil Amar, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Professor Amar.
So here we are. You've written a biography of the U.S. Constitution. It's 8,000 words. How do you make a biography out of a document, Professor Amar?
Well, it's a challenge, but the basic idea is that the Constitution it tells the story, really, of the American people over 200 years. So it's not a biography of James Madison or Ben Franklin or this or that other person. It really is the story of we the people, the American people, and not just at the founding, but over 200 years. It's not just a story about founding fathers, but about their sons and grandsons and their daughters and granddaughters, black and white, male and female, over 200 years, and the story isn't over yet. So it's an unfinished biography of the American people.
You write that before the American Revolution, no people had ever explicitly voted on their own written constitution. This was the very first time. Take us back to the culture of that period, the political culture, the evolution of political thinking. What was being demonstrated with the American Constitution?
That the people could genuinely govern themselves and that they could do so across an entire continent. Today we look around the world and we see democracy ascendant. Billions of people in India and the Europe and North America and much of South America and now even Russia coming on board in the former Soviet republics and in Africa too. Democracy is on the march. We're even trying to be introduced into the Mideast. But in 1787, there were very few self-governing places in the entire planet or the history of the planet. England to some degree, Switzerland to some degree, maybe the Netherlands, and that was about it. And in history, it had been worked democracy in small city-states, Athens and Sparta, but it had never been made to work on a continental scale, and that's what America tries to do. And it's going to put its basic rules up to a special vote, which had never happened really even in any of the places I mentioned. They had democratic ways of life to some degree, but the people had never written a document and then voted on it.
And here we are all these years later, still working off that document, working very hard to interpret what it means and what it doesn't mean. We're going to look at how the original intent was spun out here, but I don't want to go past the moment that Americans did this thing a couple hundred years and more ago,
and the sense of just how pleased they were with what they had done, which you capture wonderfully. Akhil Amar, you've got a bit of oration here and a setup for it from James Wilson, speaking in Philadelphia. Who was Mr. Wilson?
James Wilson was a quintessential American, even though you haven't heard very much about him. He was born, he was an immigrant, a poor boy or made good. He was born in Scotland and educated in Edinburgh. He comes over to the United States. He's one of six men to sign both the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. He's the one who at Philadelphia writes the words, "We the people of the United States." He's a big believer in popular sovereignty. He's actually anti-slavery. He's one of the first six justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. He's appointed to that position by George Washington. He's generally regarded as perhaps the greatest lawyer of his generation. And you haven't heard as much about him because he dies in debt and disgrace and he doesn't leave a lot of papers. But his were the ideas really that very much influenced the path of American history.
With that little biographical sketch, I wish you'd read for us the setup here and then his oration from that time that just bursts with the pride, the momentousness that Americans felt in achieving this document.
Thanks. Here's the passage. As Benjamin Franklin and other Americans had achieved famous advances in the natural sciences, in Franklin's case, the invention of bifocals, the lightning rod, and the Franklin stove, so with the Constitution, America could boast a breakthrough in political science. Never before had so many ordinary people been invited to deliberate and vote on the supreme law under which they and their posterity would be governed. James Wilson fairly burst with pride in an oration delivered at Philadelphia to some 20,000 merrymakers gathered for a grand parade on July 4th, 1788. By that date, enough Americans had said, "We do," so as to guarantee that the Constitution would go into effect. And here's now James Wilson's remarks. "The spectacle which we are assembled to celebrate was the most dignified one that had yet appeared on our globe. A people free and enlightened, establishing and ratifying a system of government which they have previously considered, examined, and approved. You have heard of Sparta, of Athens, and of Rome. You have heard of their admired constitutions and their high-prized freedom. But did they, in all their pomp and pride of liberty, ever furnish to the astonished world an exhibition similar to that which we now contemplate? Were their constitutions framed by those who were appointed for that purpose, by the people? After they were framed, were they submitted to a consideration of the people? Had the people an opportunity of expressing their sentiments concerning them? Were they to stand or fall by the people's approving or rejecting vote?" So that's the Wilson quote. And then here's how I conclude. "The great deed was done. The American people had taken center stage and enacted their own supreme law."
Akhil Reed Amar, reading from his new book, America's Constitution, A Biography. Jack, you can just see that picture, 20,000 people in Philadelphia, James Wilson bursting with pride at what had been accomplished and squeaked through on the vote across the colonies or the free states at that point. And here we are, 200-plus years later, and now Sam Alito in the hot seat, that Constitution still red and red and red, looking for what we need to take from it now.
Yeah, I wonder how many of us, though, would have been among the cheering throng there in Philadelphia. I mean, that is, if we were to draft the Constitution today, how would we change it? And what does that, the changes we would make, tell us about the faults in the original document? And I don't just mean slavery, suffrage, things like that. I mean the structural issues. You know, on the Electoral College, for example, four presidential election winners of popular vote didn't take office, and in one of them, Tilden won a majority. He didn't take office. 18 elections, the presidents won with a minority of the popular vote. And, of course, this is partly because of the nature of the Senate and the Electoral College. And James Wilson spoke to this. He says, "Can we forget for whom we're forming a government? Is it for men or for imaginary beings called states? I don't know as we would go along with this anti-democratic institution that gives states, these imaginary beings, a right over men. And second, look at judicial power. Would we really, would the framers really have given the judiciary the kind of scope it has taken if they had lived through, say, the 19th century and had seen judge-made law, or, as conservatives say today, if they had seen so many judges legislating from the bench? Was that not a fault in the original document, the leeway given to this unelected branch?
Akhil Amar, a couple of things. A century ago, Charles Beard wrote that the U.S. Constitution was almost a plutocratic in its affections. You say it's democratic. What about that? We'll come back to the judicial power, but what do you see fundamentally on that seesaw?
My book takes issue with Charles Beard, who presented the Constitution as anti-democratic. I show in my book, with data that Beard actually suppressed, the Constitution was far more democratic than anything that had ever before existed in the planet. But what Beard missed, which would have supported to some degree his critical view of the Constitution, was the document was also more pro-slavery than we've acknowledged. And that connects to the Electoral College. And so here's why it was more democratic. People got to vote on it, and the election rules that were in place in voting on the Constitution, actually in 8 of the 13 states, allowed people who ordinarily didn't meet standard property qualifications to either vote for the Constitution or vote for the delegates that were going to be ratifying or not ratifying the document, or to actually be one of those delegates. So ordinary property qualifications were lowered or gotten rid of in 8 of the 13 states. So it really was a we the people moment.
Akhil Amar, what about this issue of judicial activism? It's very much on the lips of American conservatives in recent decades. Take us back, and we're going to ask you to take us back down several streams here, but take us upstream, back to the beginning on this point of how the constitutional framers imagined the role of the judiciary, what the Constitution itself has to say about it, how they might see what's happened today.
The framers listed the judicial branch third out of three. And they did so, in my view, because actually they were basically Democrats, and the judiciary is the least democratic of the three branches. So the document begins, we the people, that's the preamble, and that's where the most people are allowed to very directly get involved, as I mentioned before the break, getting to vote on the Constitution itself and in a special election with especially expansive rules of inclusion. Then Article 1, the legislature, and the House of Representatives is directly elected by the people in ways that the Confederation Congress had not been, so it's pretty democratic. Then Article 2, especially for the time. Mm. Article 2, the presidency, it's indirectly elected, and Jack mentioned the Electoral College. I hope we can get back to it. James Wilson preferred direct election. He lost on that, and the story is interestingly connected to slavery, but we'll get back to that. Mm-hmm. The judiciary is mentioned third because it's actually least accountable and directly selected by the people. So the kind of grand democratic pyramid from the preamble, the most inclusive, to the legislature, the next most inclusive, to the executive. And then the judiciary is last and least of the branches. It's probably not that today. So their least dangerous branch has become today's ultimate interpreter of the Constitution. And part of the reason why, there are lots of things that have happened over 200 years, part of this life story, but here's just one important factoid. At the time that the Constitution was first put into place, there are not very many federal judges. There are about there are 7 congresspersons for every federal judge. Today, there are 2 federal judges for every congressperson. The federal judiciary has gone from about a size of 20, the lower federal courts, to over 1,000. So ordinary people today are much more likely to maybe know a judge than they are even their Congress member. My students are much more likely to work for judges than they are to intern for senators or representatives. And so the judiciary is a lot more powerful today than it was 200 years ago.
So how do you deal with changes like that? They didn't imagine that number of judges, perhaps not even that powerful for the judiciary. So is this an outrage against the Constitution, whose biography you write, or is it natural evolution that we should accept and embrace? That's at the heart of a lot of debate right now.
Well, it depends on the issue. One important thing to remember is how significant constitutional amendments are. That's a middle way. The document isn't just carved in stone. It's not like the Bible where the canon is closed. We're not going to add a new gospel or a new epistle, or the Old Testament. That's a closed document. The Constitution is an open one, and over the years we've had lots of amendments, and many of these amendments have actually been ones contemplating a more active judicial role, perhaps, than was true at the founding. For example, after the Civil War, the document was amended by three Reconstruction amendments, one of which, the 14th Amendment, very much envisions a role for Congress, to be sure, but also for the courts to enforce all sorts of rights, freedoms, privileges, and immunities, including ones that didn't quite exist at the founding.
So amendments, as you write, the people, if they make them, they're free to, because it's we the people at the outset. The power is still vested there, not in a stone tablet, but in a living people, if not a living document.
And over the years, I think the American people have chosen, both in the document and in their laws, to give judges more power than was envisioned at the founding. And what goes up possibly could come down. If Congress, for example, wanted to, in theory, it would be free to cut the size of today's judiciary. And if it did so, it's possible that the federal judiciary would be somewhat less powerful than it is today. And Congress is free to do that.
Jack, here's a constitution that, as Akhil Amar begins to lay out for us, has gone through some very substantial evolution over its lifetime, coming up to 2006 here. Hardly a static document.
Hardly at all. And in fact, you could almost say there have been three constitutions. His colleague Bruce Ackerman pretty much makes that case, the original one. And then the everyman's constitution, the constitution for all Americans, for all persons born or naturalized in the United States, as the 14th Amendment reads, and that is to black Americans as well. That was a new founding, those three amendments. And suddenly this document didn't just apply to white males. It applied to all males. But, you know, sadly, and partly because of the nature of that Supreme Court, this vision was aborted, and this new beginning was snuffed out. And it turned out that the person protected by the 14th Amendment was not the Negro, was not the freedman, as the Supreme Court wrote construed it. No, the person was the corporation. As Hugo Black pointed out in 1938, of the cases in this court in which the 14th Amendment was applied during the first 50 years after its adoption, less than one half of 1% invoked it in protection of the Negro race. And more than 50% asked that its benefits be extended to corporations. This was one of the great perversions and betrayals in American judicial history, how this institution turned its back, the court, on the 14th Amendment and on the rights of the freedmen, dooming the African Americans in the South to 100 years of segregation and, in many cases, terrorism.
We're talking this hour about the life story of the U.S. Constitution as Sam Alito sits down before the Senate for its hearings on his nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I want to pull the conversation into that arena. Maybe to help us do it, let's listen for just a moment to two takes from television ads, one liberal and one conservative, on the nomination of Judge Alito.
Your private conversations, your personal decisions. If you don't want more government interference, you don't want Samuel Alito on the Supreme Court. An independent analysis found Alito often goes out of his way to narrow the scope of individual rights.
Despite winning bipartisan praise, some liberals still launch untrue attacks. But Alito is a fair judge who's much closer to the center of American public opinion than his critics.
There it is, two takes on Judge Alito as the Senate begins its hearings this week on his nomination to the Supreme Court. Akhil Amar, we've just got a couple of minutes here. The Senate's going to have tough questioning all this week of Sam Alito. As you listen, as we all listen and watch this, is it possible for the United States to drift away from the intention and protections of its own Constitution to the left or right? Or do you see something that necessarily keeps us anchored? There's clearly so much room for interpretation here. How strong an anchor, the U.S. Constitution?
only as strong as we, the people in this generation, make it by reading and rereading the Constitution and learning about it. Over history, the court has drifted quite far, for example, to the right of the document. That's what Jack was saying. After the Civil War, it was about the amendments. We, the people, said we want to protect black people. But instead, for 50 years, the courts give us protections of corporations and employers and things that the amendment wasn't quite about. So it's quite possible for judges to drift to the right of the document or to the left of the document. And the only real anchor is lots and lots of Americans who read and reread the document and learn its history and know the biography, know the life story, know what it really says, so that they are really equipped to say when a judge makes something up, hey, wait a minute, that's really not what we the people agreed to.
Jack, American senators will be the interpreters of that will of the people this week in Washington.
Yes, they will. And, you know, they're going to be talking about a lifetime appointment. And that's the hard part, Akhil. I mean, the people, once they're on that court, the people can't touch them. They're beyond us. And we can read the words all we want. But if that court decides to go off in a very different direction, in the direction that George Bush wants it to go off, well, that at least according to the polls, in many respects, would be an anti-majoritarian direction, one that many or perhaps most Americans wouldn't want. But once that they're on that court, they can do it.
Akhil Amar, there it is. Lifetime is a long time, even in constitutional history.
Yep, and it shows the power of the presidency, which we talked about before. The reason the court today is a pretty conservative court is we've had a largely conservative president. 7 of the current 9 justices are appointed by Republican presidents. If you don't like that, you got to vote for someone else and win next time.
So pick up the vote. Akhil Amar, his new book is America's Constitution, A Biography. We're going to come back and ask you about this when all the dust settles, Professor Amar. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Jack Beattie, thanks for your time. Great to have you.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.